Welcome to the latest Enterprise Times Security Podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. My guest today is David Gray, Director, Global Digital Forensics and Incident Response Lead at NTT. Today, we're going to talk about incident response and what companies need to consider when building their incident response plan. Hello, David.
Hi there. As you said, David Gray, Director of Consulting at NTT Security, the security arm of NTT Limited. I run our global digital forensics and incident response team. I have had a background in incident response. I started off my career in the Air Force doing cyber intrusion out of the UK. And I've done one form of incident response or malware analysis or computer forensics over the course of my career, last 15, 20 odd years.
We're going to talk about incident response, something I know you cover a lot of the time, and you and I have spoken about this before. No matter the size of an organization, people need to deal with cybersecurity incidents. But survival comes down to your planning. What have you done? What have you put in place? How are you going to react? Where do businesses begin when it comes to designing that incident response plan?
For an incident response plan, you need to have buy-in from your management. You need to be able to understand what is the crown jewels within the business that you are covering. If you don't know that, then don't even bother starting. You need to understand what you're there for and what you're doing. From that point on, it's actually building out and establishing who you need to involve for the incident response plan, not just from your own security team, but the external teams that will interface with you when the worst happens. The whole point of having an incident response plan, it's a guide. It's there to help you speed up your response and be able to get to the people that you need to talk to quicker, bring down that dwell time for the attacker to actually get working on the incident as quickly as possible with everybody that you need there to help you do so.
You mentioned crown jewels, but for many companies, they don't know what that actually means. Is that every system? Is that customer-only facing systems? Is that back-end systems? What constitutes the crown jewels of your IT infrastructure?
Exactly. I wouldn't expect your average SOC analyst to know that to start with. That's got to be something that comes down from the business. People that actually run and maintain security operation centres have to interface with the business owners to understand what's critical to them. Then the security team should be interfacing with the IT team to understand where all that data is actually resident and what systems are key to keeping that up and keeping the business running.
Where does that overlap with things like business continuity, disaster recovery, business resilience?
It's part of all of those plans. First of all, business resiliency and business continuity. So continuity is about keeping the business up and running. Business resiliency is about making sure that your SOC and your security team kind of stop that in the first place, that you are already defeating this threat from actually happening. So resilience is about keeping things from happening, to actually keep your business running rather than the threat occurring and you having to deal with it.
What about disaster recovery?
From a security perspective, disaster recovery, the security team has to interface into that 100%, but it's not the primary purpose for that security team. It is a different business owner that would be responsible for that. But from another point of view, a response plan, disaster recovery plan, those are just small pieces of a much, much larger puzzle. Organizations really have to think about it and look at this from one end of the scale to the other. What am I talking about? Things like a forensic strategy. How are you going to collect your evidence? Where's it all stored? Do you have any data privacy considerations to take in? Financial strategy. How is the business going to deal with the financial implications? If it's a ransomware, are you going to pay a ransom? Is your insurance organization going to stump up the Bitcoin demand? Regulations, how do you deal with GDPR, everything that's incorporated that? Legal, your media strategy, law enforcement strategy. You can see where I'm getting. There's just so many pieces to look at.
It's interesting listening to that because I suspect for a lot of people, they think about their incident response as an internal thing that will be run by the security team. But when you start talking about legal, that's often external advisors. How quickly do people realize that this is not just something that two or three people in the organization are going to sit down, instantiate and run, but it has to include a wide array of actors, both internal and external.
Yeah, exactly. Anything of this large scale, the easiest way to figure out how many people you actually need when an incident happens is actually to have an incident. But that's obviously the worst case scenario. You definitely don't want to be in that scenario. Running things like tabletops, one of the easiest way to shake out who you need to talk to, because people actually start saying, oh, I need to talk to such and such team. But if you have no way of doing so, how do you do that when you come to the real world example?
If we look around, advice is to constantly be running tabletop exercises, practice, rehearse. But if you don't know what you're practicing, if you don't know what you're rehearsing, you don't know who you need to include in those teams.
That's why you reach out to external suppliers to be able to deliver those kind of exercises. They can actually build it out around your business and whatever is important to the business itself. The number one thing people tend to look at the moment is ransomware, but that doesn't have to be necessarily what the scenario would be. It's very easy for the response team or the security team that are doing the consulting to be able to throw things in scenarios that people wouldn't necessarily think about. Say you've just had your entire business compromised. How do you therefore notify all your clients? You can't just send out an email to every single person. You've got to deal with external organizations that do that on your behalf. What happens when half your client base phones into the help desk to make complaints and the help desk PBX system goes down? There's things like that that you can throw in as injects that just make things a little bit more interesting and actually force the security team to think in different ways that they wouldn't necessarily have done so themselves. That's the whole point with using an external provider.
When you describe that list of challenges and everything else, one of the things that strikes me is who should be in charge? The natural thing is to think that this is something run by a CISO, but would that CISO know who all the other people are who are involved? If those people are in the organization, on holiday or left, do we need to make sure we've got buy-in from HR, either as support or maybe even HR acting as a gatekeeper to some degree?
I would agree with that. I think every single incident response plan, no matter what it is, whichever organization has to have HR in there, as well as media and all the rest of it. Whether they should be the ones to own it, I don't necessarily think that would be the case. I think the CISO ultimately is the person that would own the incident response plan. But yeah, 100%, HR should definitely be included.
How often do you see main boards understand an incident response plan and, more importantly, buy into the incident response plan?
It is getting better. We saw a survey just in the last year that only about 25% of organisations even have an incident response plan. Of that 25%, only half of those actually know what the plan contains. As far as boards are concerned, I think it's getting better, yes. But there's still a long, long way to go. We see this all the time with the amount of breaches that are occurring. It seems to be almost every other week that there's something in the news. If organisations are prepared in advance, things aren't going to be as bad as they are.
I'm struck by how unprepared CEOs and CTOs are when they're suddenly put in front of a camera. Is that, do you think, because they haven't done incident response planning or because the communication between them as the person people are looking at and the people trying to deal with the incident is often poorly designed?
In a lot of cases, I think the person that's going to end up in front of the media doesn't actually know that they're the person that's going to end up in front of the media. That's certainly been evident in the last couple of years. I'm not going to call it any specific cases, but there has been people stood in front of cameras on behalf of the company that have just been reading off a script that they've had in front of them and have not actually understood what's happening to the case that's running in the background. They really, really need to be part of that incident response planning, because you don't want to be that person that stood in front of the cameras having to explain what's happening when you've never had any training for dealing with the media or in a real world scenario. Prior planning prevents poor performance or other versions of that. I certainly live by, what was it to say? Failing to plan is planning to fail.
If we look at where these attacks are coming now, you talked earlier about crown jewels and the complexity of an organisation and knowing what to protect. But we're not seeing attacks necessarily now coming at what we would have seen as our core systems. They're now going after what have been treated as ancillary systems, IoT, are OT systems, systems that often are poorly understood in an organization. How much does incident response planning give you an opportunity to better understand the scope of your infrastructure and, more importantly, the risk factor?
From the OT IR side, you have to think about this from your traditional security analyst point of view. They've been trained to deal with IT environments that we all know and love for the last 20 years. When you start bringing in things like pumps and switches and healthcare, things that are actually connected up to living human beings, the risks are massive and are completely outside of the scope for what would be a traditional SOC. From a risk perspective, it's essential that the SOC staff are interfacing with the security engineers themselves. SOC staff will never themselves understand, and I don't mean that in any disrespect to the security teams that are dealing with it. It's just, it's a different kind of skill set.
But it's a different world as well, isn't it? Many of those OT systems were not installed by IT. They were installed by other people who had other priorities when they were putting them in. Security often wasn't one of those priorities.
100%. And from another perspective, for some of those security consultants, they might not have actually been born when that system was implemented. These systems have had hundreds, if not thousands, of vulnerabilities because they were never actually designed to be on a network with Windows and everything else that we utilize for our daily business. Obviously, there should be tons and tons of other security constraints, firewalls, and specialized security monitoring tools in place to monitor that. But yeah, it's an interesting problem. And it's something that I think the industry is getting a lot better at, but we're not there yet.
How easy is it to keep your incident response plan dynamic and living? If we look at the last 18 months, for example, nobody would have realized just how fast remote work has taken over. Nobody could have planned for the number of attack points that have now been opened up with people being at home using their own devices connecting into the enterprise. Incident response plans that were put in place 2 years ago would have been hard pressed to have dealt with an incident over the last 2 years if they weren't continuously being modified. Is there a risk of people creating a static plan on a one and done type mentality rather than constant review?
There is definitely a risk there. To start off with, first of all, incident response plans are a guideline. They are the framework that helps everybody understand what they're supposed to be doing. From that aspect, I think, yes, they definitely have a place and they can be very much static in nature, but organizations have to be able to flex when incidents actually happen and not be absolutely rigid to what they've set out beforehand. You should still absolutely know what your escalation points are, what your workflow is, who to talk to, who to reach out to. But from the team's perspective itself, as in how the security team is dealing with a response, that has completely changed in the last 2 years. The old way of doing it was you have an incident, you all go into your nice war room, you have your whiteboard, you start working and understanding how to do so. If you are now working from home, as certainly we've all been doing over the last year, you don't have that opportunity. And you may have actually just lost your ability to communicate because the ransomware has just encrypted the system that you're working on. So yeah, definitely having backup alternates for communication plans, 100%. And the other aspect is, how do you make things better? The number one change I think we've had in the marketplace over the last couple of years has been EDR solutions. They don't necessarily replace SIEMs or IDS systems, but having a system that you can, as a security team, remotely reach out to your affected systems to be able to remediate and quarantine. I don't think we could have dealt with a lot of the security incidents that have come up over the last year or two without EDR solutions. I think that's going to be a big changing point. Managed service providers such as ourselves that are doing the MDR solutions that help organizations by taking a lot of that heavy lifting for them.
One challenge with people being at home is if the incident occurs in an office, you have a boundary. You can shut down all the machines in the office. You can start to clean. Once this is being handled by people working at home, often connecting into cloud-based systems. How do you begin to decide who you lock out, how you lock people out, what needs cleaning, what needs remediating, what will be dealt with by the cloud provider, what are you going to deal with? There's an awful lot of decisions that have to be made there, and they have to be made quickly. Is it easy to plan for that, or is that something that has to adapt and evolve as soon as the incident occurs?
There's two ways of doing it, and the preferred option is you've planned for this ahead of time, you've got the business buy-in, you know what systems within the network that you have authority to quarantine. Obviously, that's the quickest one because you've already got that authority. The less preferable is to have somebody from within the business that's assisting on the actual incident on your crisis bridge, that's making the decisions there and then at that point in time. That can lead to errors. It's obviously a lot of responsibility for that person that's making those decisions. But again, you need to have had that sort of planning to be able to support them when that happens.
In terms of understanding where the risk might come from, there's an awful lot of information that companies can gain access to. NTT, for example, I know you guys put out a monthly GTIR report and you put out a yearly report. In addition to that, you provide customers an awful lot of threat information. How do customers begin to absorb that information into their incident plan? Because for many of them, they're still struggling to deal with the day-to-day security rather than the it's all gone wrong moment.
Firstly, these reports are coming from real-world experience, from intelligence that NTT is seeing across the backbone of the internet, the security monitoring for. This is all based on fact and the trends that we're seeing. I can elaborate on some of those trends later on if you want. It helps to have the fact of what's happening in the environment on the internet to be able to make your business decisions on. The biggest change that we've seen, I don't think anybody would dispute this, has been the massive, massive rise that we've seen in ransomware over the last couple of years. Just in the last 2 years alone, we've seen a 300% increase in ransomware. The more targeted approach that they've had, certainly against healthcare and some of the other organizations that have been trying to help the global community when with COVID. Coming back to the question, use that information that we have in our reports as the basis to help you make valued decisions and where to focus your planning.
That also brings us back to the question of integration, because it's very easy to see planning as something that's done in a book. We take it down maybe once a month, we update it with some new information we've got, and we put it back. It's not part of what we do daily. How do we make incident response an integrated part of what we do in the IT environment? Or is that something that we hand to our external partners?
Well, as an external partner, I would probably be suggesting that organizations hand it off to another organization. But in all seriousness, there's multiple different tiers of security and security teams. Your traditional level one, level two, level three that you'd see in a traditional SOC, and then incident response teams themselves that deal with the blue light activities. For a lot of organizations, being able to hire and maintain really highly skilled people is tough. These people they're expensive. They have very specialized skill sets. If you're not doing this on a daily basis, you're going to get skill fade. I think that you hire the critical staff that you need to be able to deal with what you perceive to be the limit of your own security team and then export the rest out, whether that be to a managed service provider for doing the day-to-day monitoring or to a team to handle that emergency response. But if you do that, make sure that it's all built into your incident response plan, you know who's doing what, and each team for either the MSS or the incident response team knows how to interface with your team and vice versa.
There's a danger with that export, and that is that people abdicate responsibility. We saw it early on, particularly with small to medium-sized companies when it came to cloud. If I give somebody else that responsibility, I am no longer liable. Well, of course, that's a complete error of judgment. You are still liable. You can't just abdicate your responsibility by giving it to somebody else. When you engage with customers and you're taking this over and you're working with them, how often do they want to stay in the loop? And how often do you see people not quite wanting you to do everything, but actually thinking that giving it to you is the job done?
I'll speak from the incident response side of things. That's my area of expertise. A lot of organizations see incident response as being effectively an insurance policy, which in many cases it is. They tend to view that it's tick box, it's done. I know I've got an incident response plan. I know that I have a team ready to parachute in and assist when the worst happens. That's the bad side of it, being prepared. It's not the worst case because, you know, you have people ready on standby. Our teams make sure that we interface with the security team to understand the crown jewels and all the rest of it. But it's only at a point in time. It's the start when you onboard your partner, that you go through and understand what is the business needs, where all the servers are. But it could be another year before we're actually talking to the security team. Personally, our own incident response team, we touch base with our clients about once every 12 weeks or so to make sure that if they've had any incidents that weren't of something of a large enough scale to involve the incident response team, that we know about it. Because if something does happen, we don't want to be tripping over an incident that isn't part of the main one, that we're still seeing some residue floating around. Ultimately, it all comes down to communications. The more communications you do, either with external organisations or within your own team, it can only make things better.
You've mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about areas to focus on, the idea of forensics. One of the problems we have with most people's incident response is their priority is to get the business back and functional. It is not to preserve evidence for a forensic examination later on, either by themselves or by law enforcement. How do companies go about bringing the two together? Because clearly, the longer my business is down, the more money I lose. If I don't gain the forensics, we can't bring somebody to justice. But both have separate needs.
I'd add one more need onto there as well. The reason for forensics is root cause analysis, as in, how did this happen in the first place so it doesn't happen again? I think businesses really just need to be practical about this. Have forensics as part of their incident response plan so that they know what they're going to do, how to do it, and have the tools available. It becomes part of the process that, yes, we have an incident, right? Let's capture a snapshot of the virtual machine. We'll just keep that off in another system. And now, you know, it's to one side, the forensic team can actually start working on it while we go about starting to recover services. The same for physical builds. Let's take a quick snapshot, the forensic image of that particular system, because we perceive that that might have been the entry point. Then we'll flatten the system, we'll reboot it, we'll get things back up and running. But at the same time, we still can go back and do the analysis of how this happened in the first place. As part of that, make sure you've got all your logs, you've got your external SIEM that's recording everything, because if you're just relying upon the logs that are on the systems, 30 days and they're gone in most cases, and if the attacker's got on the network, then they've already deleted them for you anyway. That's another one to add to the list.
So this is a point where I put everybody on the spot on these podcasts. You're facing a room full of people who are just starting out building incident response plans. They may have experience in security. They may not have experience in cybersecurity. What three things would you tell them to focus on as they start to put plans together?
First thing to look at is who you need to talk to and make friends. Talk to people within your organization. Talk to people within law enforcement that can help you. That's the number one thing. Next one is understand where decisions have to get made, as in, when an incident, you need to understand when you're going from just having discovered something that might be a bit of malware to somebody actually having to make a decision about calling in other teams. Understand those decision points and make sure that everybody understands the workflow that those fit into. And then the next one is, you know, how to actually resolve it. What systems you need to give you the more information to be able to resolve the incident. If you haven't got the information, where you can get that information from, whether it be Windows machines, whether you've got an EDR, whatever. And if you haven't got it, who to go to buy it for you.
I guess one of the challenges for organizations is always going to be, how do we react to something that's gone wrong? But let's hope as we see more and more incidents, people learn lessons and get to grips with it.
Agreed. Yeah.
Thank you for talking with me, David.
Thanks, Ian. It's been a pleasure.